Welcome to Off Court, the Business of Sport podcast, where business and sports culture meet. Let's go. Kick it off, Robbie.
On this episode of the Sports and Business podcast, we're very fortunate to be joined by Bianca Chatfield. Bianca had an incredible career spanning across something like 16 or 17 years, 59 appearances for Australian netball, Melbourne Vixens captain, Comm Games gold medalist, six-time premiership player, and the list goes on and on. In this episode, we're going to hear about not only how Bianca excelled on the court, but also her growth mindset off the court, as well as appearing on The Block. Enjoy. Bianca, welcome to the Sports and Business podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's always great to chat about sport, but all the other stuff that goes around it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, first off, a massive congratulations. You recently announced that you're expecting. How exciting.
Yeah, super exciting. And I mean, I'm a first-time mum, so for everyone out there who already has kids, I'm sure there's plenty of advice that you can throw our way. But yeah, it's all exciting, a bit nerve-wracking, but yeah, certainly ready, I think, to live a less selfish life, I think.
No, that's awesome. So how are you doing and how's sort of lockdown been treating you?
Yeah, look, lockdown's been okay. Sadly, I think that we're just so used to it here in Melbourne, and we're almost lockdown fit that it's like, oh yeah, another one, here we go again. And we're getting very good at entertaining ourselves. And I've moved house during the recent lockdown. So for me, I've been doing as many different DIY renovation projects as I possibly can, even things that don't even really need to be done. But that just is a way of me amusing myself because I'm not very good at sitting still. And that's probably something I've really had to teach myself during lockdown. But also, you know, once athlete life finished for me, it was, you know, learning that it's actually okay sometimes to sit still and not be constantly trying to action something or achieving something. And yeah, so that certainly is a big, I guess, thing for my brain to tackle, is like sometimes you have to sit still and there's no choice.
For sure. Well, let's start with that. You've had an illustrious career, obviously very celebrated athlete, but how did you kind of get into the sport, I suppose, first off? And how do you think the sort of talent pathway that you went through has kind of changed now, if at all?
Yeah, so for me, I think I started playing netball. I play basketball a lot too, but I'm 6 foot two, so I'm 189 centimetres. And for a female, that is very tall. And instantly, you know, my parents were always about, you've got to be active, you've got to be outside, you can't be sitting in front of the TV. So we were just automatically thrown into playing different sports on the weekends. And to be honest, it was the one place I actually probably felt really confident about my height, because when I wasn't playing sport, I hated it. I hated, you know, standing out in a crowd, and I always just wanted to be like my friends, and they were all tiny. And so I think for me, it was just almost a place of just connection and feeling confidence in myself to start with. And then I really have this competitive nature in me where I loved the challenge of, you know, if you lost a game or if you were on the bench, you know, how do you get yourself out there on court and how do you actually have an impact? And I really enjoyed just being driven by something and having teammates around you that really push you. So probably my pathway, because I was tall, I was started off as a shooter, and I actually ended majority of my career, I played in the defense end, because not many tall people want to play defense, and that kind of helped my pathway. But I think nowadays there's a lot more tall girls playing netball. And so who knows if I would have been able to navigate it as quickly as what I did. But I was fortunate enough to make the Aussie team at 18, which was so young. And I didn't even, you know, I wasn't even good enough at that stage. I was just someone young with potential. So I think the pathways are quite similar now, but I think it's certainly more challenging. And there's also other sports that distract you. It's not just girls play netball and boys play football. There's very much now an absolute monopoly of female sports that you can play. And I think I would have been quite challenged by making that decision about what I would have chosen, probably had I had that selection around me.
I had no idea that you started as a shooter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's natural that most tall people will go into the shooting end. And I had a coach, and I think I would have been 13 or 14, who was like, there's no tall defenders. We need some tall defenders. Like, we're going to throw you back down there. And I'm like, oh, how boring. No, I don't want to play that. And And that's probably another good lesson, is that sometimes people around you know probably more about your skill set and where you're more suited than what you actually think at the time. So that certainly did help me leapfrog, I think, a few different athletes along the way. It was because I was one of few tall defenders coming up against a lot of these tall shooters that most of the teams and different states had at the time.
And how did you, as you said, you debuted very young. How did you handle sort of that pressure and that responsibility, or the, you know, the weight on your shoulders at such a young age?
One thing I didn't probably do enough of was like celebrate it all, because I was very much, when it was happening, I was excited like internally, but everyone wanted to make a fuss, and I was very much new that I was picked in the side as a young up and coming player, and that I had replaced someone who was pregnant. So she was out for 12 months, knowing full well she was going to come back after that. And so I was kind of trying to keep it on the down low and make sure that, you know, oh no, no, it's just, you know, it's just giving me an opportunity, but you know, I won't be in it for long. And then that she was like, that was right. I wasn't in it for long. I was in it for a year. And I think what I look back on now is that I probably predicted that was going to happen, but you know how you almost manifest it at the same time, rather than just challenging and trying to stay in the team. I just accepted that she was going to come back in and be better than me. And so that was a huge learning curve for me. That initial introduction of making the team was that, okay, it's actually, you can make it. It's so much harder to actually stay there. And that's when probably I was challenged the most, like mentally and physically, was being able to maintain that standard of elite game to be able to play for Australia for a long time.
And that must be so hard. But was there a particular moment that you kind of felt like, hey, I belong at this level, where it wasn't just like, they picked me because I have potential, where that kind of mentally sort of transferred to, hey, you know, this is, I'm ready for this?
Well, I think, you know, I feel like two very different parts of my career. One was, you know, with Melbourne Phoenix and Melbourne Vixens, which was my kind of home club. I played for them for 17 years. And it was probably in my early 20s where I really felt like I belonged and I contributed and I was on court all the time and I was, you know, in leadership positions early. That was where I always felt like I belonged and had a huge group of supportive teammates around me and coaches, and everyone just wanted the best for you. Whereas I found like in the Australian team was a real dog eat dog kind of world, that you were either in the starting seven or you're on the bench, but it wasn't really a place where you spent enough time to really get to know each other very well. Or I never felt like the experienced players in the side actually spent enough time getting to know us young ones. It was almost like, oh, here's another young one trying to take my position. And it probably wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I really found my place in the Australian team, that I knew I wanted to be there, that I was prepared to do anything I could. But also from a leadership perspective, I'd learned how much and how important it was to embrace the youngest person in the team or the least experienced person in the team, because of how much value they can add. It doesn't have to be just what they do on court, but how much value they can add into a team and how much energy they can give you all. So it was probably a real change in mindset from my part, where I actually felt like, oh no, I do belong here, and I have, whether I'm on the court or on the bench, it doesn't matter. I have plenty that I can add. And being around and traveling the world with these teammates who, you know, we play against each other in the National League, you could just embrace learning so much from each other as well, and training against each other all the time. You could take those skills back with you when you're back playing for Melbourne. So yeah, it was probably my late 20s. It took me a long time to really feel like that I belonged in that Australian team, even though I played in it for, I think, like 11 years all up.
Definitely. And I think one of your, well, from the outside, one of your sort of key skills, I think, is sort of that reflection and leadership. Is that something that you, I mean, you've written a couple of books as well around development and leadership. Is that something that you developed around that time? Or do you think you kind of had that ability to sort of reflect in the moment from an earlier age?
No, I don't think I did it very well when I was younger. I think I just followed other people's lead. Like, I think I saw other people do it well, and I didn't understand the value of doing it until I got in positions where I probably had no choice. The leadership part of it for me, I mean, being a female athlete, we always had to have other things going on in our life other than playing sport. You knew you were never going to make millions.
No, sorry. I do want to ask you about that as well afterwards.
Yeah. So basically you had to have something else. So I studied human movement, secondary teaching, at uni while I was, you know, starting out my elite career. And the benefit of having an education background for me was around, you know, you had time to cope with what was going on in sport because you had outlets, you had to go to work, you had to, I taught part-time for a few years. And even though that wasn't my 100% passion, I knew I wanted to be there. It was something that I could do that would really complement my sport. And so I think through that, I found the avenue of like teaching younger people and giving back to younger people and what you can actually get out of that. And so the leadership in my sport then became something that I was just really passionate about. I loved seeing other people do well and how you could actually make a difference in their careers by simply just, you know, the power of positivity when you're out there, or, you know, being a believer and an optimist rather than always focusing on the negatives and the impact that the energy that you bring to the team can have on others around you. So I think that's kind of where it started for me. And the education part of it, that's where the books came from, really, was that it was like, okay, I finished my career now. What can I package up all the stuff that I feel like I learned because I got to play elite sport when not everyone will? And how can we make sure that every young girl out there has an opportunity to live their version of what their best life might be?
Love that. And a couple of athletes that I've spoken to on this podcast kind of echo those thoughts as well around having something else off the court, so to speak, or outside the game. And it just allows you to kind of, you know, refill your glass and, you know, get a little bit of perspective on what's happening, because obviously you can get so caught up in what's happening on the field or after a game and, you know, things that happen or at training or, you know, not being picked for a certain team or whatever. What were those kind of outlets for you during your career?
Yeah, you're right. And I probably haven't had the luxury until the very end of my career where I was pretty much full-time as an athlete. So I've heard sports psychologists say it's not good to compartmentalize things when you're an athlete or when, you know, just an everyday person. But for me, I felt like that was my superpower, that, you know, when I got dropped from the Australian team at different stages and I could have a moment to switch off from that, like it hurt too much to think about it or to be back in that world trying to get back in the team, that I could go to work or I could go and, you know, study or do something away from it, because we had time. We had to have time as female athletes to be able to earn money doing other things. So, I was a teacher for a couple of years and always in private schools that could give me the flexibility to be able to travel the world as well and, you know, beg all the time going, oh, I need to go away for 3 weeks, thanks, and never in school holidays. And so I was fortunate to have a supportive environment. But from then, I actually worked at Essendon Footy Club for a few years. And I remember being at the club and all the players used to say that to me. They're like, we watched you play last night. Like, what are you doing at work today? And but for us, like, that was just a no-brainer. You get up on a Monday and you go to work. Like, you don't have... If you do recovery, it's at 6 a.m. in the morning. It's not, you know, just during the day on a Monday. And so I was at Essendon Footy Club for a little while, then branched out and with Sherelle McMahon, another netballer, and we had our own leadership business where we'd go into schools and run leadership workshops. And then I worked at Collingwood Footy Club for a little while as well in a lot of, like, player welfare development roles where I could use my education background to help. And then other than that, I've been literally freelancing and running my own kind of business on the side. But yeah, it certainly became a switch off for me from when athlete life wasn't going well. But also I had positions, whether it be in footy clubs or running my own business, where I could actually switch those off when I needed to fully focus on my athlete life. As well as being a normal, you know, everyday 20, 30-year-old where you also want to go out and enjoy being around your friends and not talking about sport or not talking about work. So, just a bit of a combination of everything. But I certainly, you know, being able to close one door and open another and revisit it when I had the energy to go back into it was really important.
Hey, guys, if you're enjoying this podcast, I would love if you could screenshot it, chuck it up on your Instagram story and tag us at offcourt.sport. All right, let's get back to it. And I had a chat with Chloe Malloy, Collingwood women's footy player, about, you know, the state of women's sport in Australia in terms of a full-time aspect, and how that's kind of developing. In comparison to some of the international competitions, particularly around, you know, soccer, football, and how they're kind of developing. What's your kind of thoughts on, you know, where that's at the moment? Because I'm sure you've got some opinions on it.
Well, for me, I have seen my sport grow significantly from when we first started. And I mean, just simply with the Australian team, you get government funding, a bit like the Olympians. So, you know, you get paid more to play for your club, to play for Melbourne, than you do to play for your country in netball. And people think that's absurd, but it's pretty much all we know. So when I first started, we were getting nothing to go away on training camps or to go away on tour for 3 weeks. And you take leave without pay from your work and you would go and get nothing. And it was all like, you didn't pay for anything. So, you know, you weren't paying for flights or uniforms or any of that, but you certainly weren't earning an income. And so by the time I had finished, you know, I was heavily involved in our players association. I just loved, you know, trying to change where we could, trying to have an impact. And what I realized for a lot of female athletes and a lot of female sports, the money is super important, yes, but it's actually all the resources around the athletes that's the most important. And from people from outside sport who look in and go, of course there should be equal pay for females and male athletes. And in a dream world, we would love that. But I think what's really key now in growing female sport is making sure that everyone has enough equipment, uniforms, everything that they need to actually be able to do their sport, enough medical cover, because all of that was what we didn't have. And that's really what netball now have managed to fight so hard for. So, you know, if you had to have an MRI on a Monday after a game, you would have to pay for that out of your own pocket. And so half the time we would, if the physio was saying you need an MRI, we'd be like, no, I'm fine. And you just would have all these injuries that would probably go really unnoticed because you didn't want to know how severe it was because you couldn't afford to actually come up with the money for the MRI. And this is way back, you know, when I was in my early 20s. But we got to a position now with netball when I retired where we were earning $500 a day to play and be on tour with the Aussie team, which is still insignificant when you compare it, but it's huge change. It's 500% more than what we were getting when I first started. And all your medical bills were paid for. And, you know, on top of that, you would have sponsorship and ambassador roles and, you know, you could quite easily have a full-time income from playing the game. Whereas, yes, that didn't obviously happen at the start. So it's got to take huge leaps forward. But I think what's really important is that whatever female sport it is that's kind of trying to move forward, that you've got to have rock solid foundations that you're moving up to. If it's just on a whim that someone goes, oh, we can give you this in 2 years' time, great. But you want to make sure that you don't actually have to go backwards because the sport don't have the money to continue to finance that part of it. And that's been always something with our Players Association with netball. We've been very passionate about pushing the sport forward, but never pushing it too far that it can't come back from that. And I mean, AFLW, I think, is an interesting one in itself. You watch how far they're coming and yes, they get a lot of media attention, but they don't necessarily get the dollars to back in probably the amount of attention that they do get publicly. And they've got so many players that they have to actually in a team look after financially, whereas netball, it's 12 people in a team. And it's much probably easier to increase the payments than it is for AFLW.
It's honestly amazing insight in regards to the resources, because that's not something that I've really heard discussed a lot. You know, it's often we hear about it's the pay and the money coming in, but you know, you put it really well. It's honestly something I haven't considered either in regards to the medical side, particularly, and obviously as well as equipment.
Yeah, even things like tape, like, you know, how you tape your ankles for training. There would be even, you know, different teams where some physios wouldn't be at training, so then the girls wouldn't have tape, so they have to go and bring their own. And that's even in, you know, more recent times, that kind of stuff that you probably take for granted. And having a massage therapist and a physio at each training session just in case you needed them. And so that's where it has certainly grown a long way.
Do you think that it's a good thing in terms of, you know, in recent years we saw like Collingwood, GWS kind of aligning with netball where they may have those foundations and we can kind of share resources?
Yeah, I think I've been really fascinated watching how that has evolved, where we've got the Giants, you know, with the Giants netball team, we've got Collingwood, we've got Melbourne Storm with Sunshine Coast Lightning. I think it's definitely challenged netball in how they do things, because it's gone, hang on a minute, we don't have to create all of these roles ourselves or pay for these roles ourselves. We've got them there already. We can share resources and we can continue to help netball think outside the square rather than do what they've always done. So there is part of me that really likes that new model. But there's also part of me that really appreciate that with Giants and with Collingwood and with Sunshine Coast Lightning, they don't have to give back to the community as much as what, say, a Netball Victoria would do, because they have an elite part of the game, but they don't necessarily have the junior pathways. So it's harder for them to recruit players because they don't have those junior pathways, but they also don't have to invest in them either. So they have more money to spend on the elite game. So that's probably a balance that Netball haven't quite figured out yet. What's the right way? You certainly want to be exposed and want to have the opportunity to learn from other sports like an AFL. It's incredible what AFL have been able to do over the years, but also making sure that you don't forget about the juniors coming up and how much they need, especially going through times like this where they can't even play at the moment because of COVID. Junior sport is going to need so much attention and so much financial support.
For sure. And post-career, I mean, you've done so much in a short space of time. Was it just something that kind of evolved, or did you have a pretty sort of clear idea of what you wanted to do? Because you did a few things while you were playing. Did that just kind of help you decide what you wanted to do post career?
Yeah, I don't think I've still figured it out, to be honest. I know it probably seems like that, but I like the education.
Yeah, it looks like you've got it very figured out.
Yeah. I don't want to fool you, but like the education, the leadership side and the media side, I'm passionate about all three. And I just feel like I've been able to build myself up and have enough experience doing a number of things that now I just try and take on things that, one, I'm passionate about, two, I know makes me feel good and I really enjoy doing it, and scares me a little bit at the same time, because as an athlete, you challenge yourself and you like to do things that really give you that adrenaline rush and make you nervous. And so I need to keep that in my life. So that, you know, doing live commentary for sport or hosting something, you know, I love that feeling where you feel a bit sick before you go live, because you think, if I stuff this up, then I'm probably never get another job again. So it makes you do the prep and it makes you, it makes you put in all the effort, which is exactly like athlete life. So I kind of, they're my three categories that I work in and around. And yeah, I'm honestly just each time keep assessing it and keep changing and keep evolving, but I certainly don't think I've got it all figured out yet.
Can we talk the block?
Sure. Oh, yeah, we forgot about that. And a bit of Reno on the side.
A bit of Reno, yeah. I am a big block fan. Not so much this year. It's a little bit too much drama for me.
The drama, I know, it's full on.
Not enough, yes. Renovating. But yeah, talk to, how did that kind of come about, and what was your experiences with that?
So it came about because I'm just a fan of the show. I would watch it all the time, like religiously. I would never miss a series. And background to that, my dad's a builder. So I've grown up, just being around building and renovating, and also just, you know, playing around in the garage with dad, where I'd be like, hey dad, I just want to make a bedside table. And I would go and, you know, get like random pallets and get the wood off there and create some random thing. And yeah, so I've just enjoyed that. And that's probably the only part of my life where I'm actually creative. And so I always wanted to do the show, but then I had this thing called netball that, you know, meant that, well,
that old chestnut.
Yeah. Reality TV is not going to stop just because, like, if you get on it. And anyway, so as I was getting towards the end of my career, I was like, I just want to do something different. I'm going to apply. But it took me about 3 years to get on. And the first time I applied, I applied with a former teammate of mine. We're the same age. Carla and I, and we're best mates. And she'd just moved to Melbourne and bought her first apartment. So I was trying to convince her that just do one little reno and you will be ready. Like, and she was so like, no chance in hell am I going to do that show. And I was like, nah, come on, let's do it. So after a couple of years of applying, we finally got there in the end. But yeah, it's probably the hardest thing I've ever done in terms of the 3.5 months that you actually do the build. It's unlike athlete life where you have all your medical care and everyone, you know, making sure you're okay, making sure you've had enough sleep. It's just literally you're thrown into this world where you have no control over anything, and you also have no, it's probably, you know, it's like a, you never know what's going to happen next. You can't even, they throw surprises on you all the time, and you just have to go with it. And, you know, I always wanted to have the answers, or I always wanted to know what was happening next, and they don't tell you. So it was a real good lesson in actually, you just got to relinquish control and just do whatever they're telling you to do. But the thing I liked about that show is it's absolutely real. Like, yes, there's a lot of drama, especially this year. But the build is real, and that if you don't do it, or if you don't hire the right trades, and if you are not wise with how you spend your money, you can't actually finish it. And they're okay if you don't finish it, because that also makes great TV, as much as doing a great room makes great TV. There's certainly elements where things get exaggerated, and, you know, Keith and Dan wandering around just bringing up stupid issues with you just to try and, you know, rev you up a bit. I found that frustrating at times, but also I quite enjoyed the banter with them. But yeah, it was just moments like that that, you know, we worked hard. Like, you sometimes will go 2 nights of absolutely no sleep in a row in a week, and it's brutal what it does to you and how you feel. But I loved it too because of the challenge, and just like being two girls on a building site, we just loved the fact that we could work hard. We knew we had that in us, and that we could just prove to everyone that you can do it. You don't have to have a trade. You just got to surround yourself with good trades that can help you. And then we had to become the laborers, because a lot of people think, oh, well, you don't need to know anything if you've just got builders. But to save money, if one of the contestants is a builder or a trade, they will then pay for laborers to be bringing everything in and out of the house or doing the demo. Whereas we had to pay for all of our trades, and so we became the labourers. So we were up the very top of our apartment block at the Gatwick, and so that was about, I think, 8 flights of stairs to get up to the top. And so we were carrying every plaster sheet and tiles and everything. It would take you all day to get a delivery of tiles up to the top, but you just do it because you had to, and that's the way that we could actually have a bit of an impact and save some money.
It must have been a huge learning curve. Like, I like a bit of DIY, but, you know, my knowledge is quite limited, I would say. But going on to something like that, which is so extravagant, you must just be absorbing info like left, right, and center.
Yep. And I honestly, it was fake it till you make it. It was just Googling everything we possibly could. And I still look at it and go, I don't know how we did it. I have no idea how we put together the house that we did. Because I think because you get to focus on one room at a time, you don't even have time to think about what's next. So you just literally, okay, how are we going to do a bathroom? What do we need? And I got a heads up from someone who'd done the show before around, get trades that don't have kids, that are young, that have done the show before, because they will be able to help guide you through. And so that's what we did. I just would look on Instagram who other contestants had used in the past. And, you know, I was like, okay, builders can only do every second year. So I was like, okay, well, who won it 2 years before us? And it was Carly and Will in Port Melbourne. I was like, great, let's just ring their builder and see if they want to work with us. And so I was just cold calling people that had done the show. And then they became probably good for us in terms of educating us, and, like, you know, hallway week is the worst week. So girls, by Monday, you have to be making sure that you're doing this, this, and this. And that was really helpful too, that they knew more than we did, and we had to listen to them.
Amazing. So we're obviously, you've got a big few months coming up. But what's next for you? Have you got anything on the go we should know about?
Well, for me, there's a lot. I'm trying to figure out in my head probably how I navigate these next few months. I'm due in Feb, so we're in September now. And I'm just working out how much I can possibly tick off before the baby comes, but also give myself some time once the baby comes. And again, it'll be like doing the block where I'm in this world I've got no idea about, and I've got to make sure that I take the time to get my head around it. But I'm going to continue to do as much as I can, especially with probably young girls and young women. Just the empowerment piece is really important to me, and the leadership piece. And I think now, especially with COVID, we're seeing a lot of a lot of people lose their way because it's really hard to figure out what you want to do or how you're going to get there at the moment. And I've got an academy with Victoria University, which is a netball academy, but we cover off a lot of, you know, things just life and personal development. And so I'll continue to do that next year as well, and work with some of my partners that I have. But yeah, for me, it'll be a really unknown year, and I'll continue to just figure it out as I go, I'm sure. And I've just moved into a new place, so now I'm tinkering along and seeing what I can change here just to keep me entertained on the weekends. But yes, I don't really have a set kind of plan. I think that's very different for me, but I'm learning that that's okay sometimes.
No, I love that. And before we wrap up, where's the best place for people to follow along your journey and keep up with what you're doing and working on?
Probably the best place, I've got a website which is just biancachatfield.com, but it's generally across LinkedIn or social media. On Instagram, I'm just at Bianca Chatfield. So most things that I'm doing, you can see there. And yeah, that most people reach out on my website for whether it's keynote speaking or leadership workshops or whatever. Yeah, I'm pretty accessible. As you found out, you just need to send me a message.
Awesome. Just slide into the DMs and you never know. Yeah. We'll include a link to your website and the Instagram as well on this podcast. But Bianca, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on. You are a wonderful role model, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Robbie.